It's the summer of 2003, and Michael Stark and Michael Lesher have just become the first same-sex marriage in Canada. Sexual orientation is being introduced into non-discrimination policies for major American corporations. An audience-challenged television network, Bravo, has recently decided to venture into reality TV. It was the summer of Boy Meets Boy.
Previously on Boy Meets Boy, James, our gay leading man, has been living a life of romantic adventure, searching for that one special someone amongst 15 handsome suitors.
Now, James is actor handsome, and he has his best friend Andor with him to suss out the suitors and offer James advice and a shoulder to cry on if needed. Boy Meets Boy was pretty much The Bachelor, but gay and with a BFF. James had been opening champagne and handing out roses all summer, and now he was down to the final three. British presenter Danny Bear sits James down to tell him the final twist.
So here it is, the final, and I promise you, final twist. Are you ready for it?
Yes.
Are you sure? Because fasten your seatbelt, James. It's going to be the bumpiest ride of all.
Ready? Okay, yes.
Okay. Of all the three final mates, Wes, Brian and Franklin, one of them is straight.
Wow.
Wow, indeed. Spoiler alert, Wes was gay.
When I came on the show, my main objective was that I wanted America to see the truth about gay men. Not the stereotypes, real gay men.
This is Get Queer, and I'm Mel Woods. This season, we're looking at reality TV and its effect on queer identity, in the community, in the world, and in the mirror. This episode, gay streaming. This is Wes Colwell.
It's crazy because you do these shows and, you know, you're not prepared. I think people are a little more savvy to the media game now. But at 23 years old, when you did this shoot for 11 days in Palm Springs, and all of a sudden you're being whisked around. I was on the Today Show doing covers of magazines. There was a billboard of us on Sunset. It was just so fast and so overwhelming. We were doing a press tour, I think somewhere in Florida, and we had been out being crazy 23-year-old kids and, you know, all hungover in the morning. And one of my castmates came running to the door and pounding on the door. And I didn't know what had happened. I thought someone got lost the night before, who knows? But it was page 6 of the USA Today. Kisses of the Year. And it was the page of the paper. It was Michael Jackson and Lisa Marie Presley, Alan Tipper Gore, Madonna and Britney, and James the Bachelor and myself for our final kiss from the show. And my brain just short-circuited. I didn't know what to even do with that, because here's our little show that we shot in Palm Springs in a week and a half. And it really was this moment like, oh, wow, this is going to be bigger than I thought it was. Back in the day, my background was actually not for profit. I was working at the Gay and Lesbian Center in San Diego, and my focus was on really getting a new generation of donors. So we were doing small donors, we were doing bar outreach, and that's where the producers, the casting producers of Boy Meets Boy found me. And every night they'd ask me to come in for an interview, and I refused. I was like, I'm not interested in doing a reality TV show. Thank you so much. I mean, this is a time where reality was kind of starting to shift, where it was getting a little more exploitative and it was getting a little bit meaner, but it wasn't quite there yet. So I was interested, but I turned them down a few nights in a row. And finally, just so I could do my job, I said, I'll come in on Monday. Just stop talking to me. I've got to be out here fundraising. So I went on a Monday. I did an interview and we were in Palm Springs like a month later. It was very fast, very fast. How much do I dish? How much do I gossip here? So it's funny, you know, I think at that time, I mean, this is what, 21, 22 years ago, people weren't quite, well, you knew reality was kind of schlocky and there was kind of this, you know, manipulation. It's not real. It's not reality. But we all went into it. And again, we didn't know the twist. I mean, none of us had any idea. We thought it was the Gay Bachelor. I mean, Bravo at the time hadn't even put on Queer Eye. It was like Boston Pops and Columbo reruns. I mean, Bravo was a channel that you happened to have in your package that you didn't want.
Poor old Bravo. At this time, 2002, Bravo was aware that there was an audience for queer content, and so they chased it, you know, as networks will do. They'd been experimenting with queer programming since 1999, first with Fire Island, about two couples, one gay, one lesbian, vacationing on Fire Island. Then in 2002, they had some success with their show Gay Weddings, which was about, you guessed it, gay weddings. And today it would probably be considered more documentary than reality. It got some attention, and it brought some attention to its producer, Douglas Ross, who was approached by the network's owner, NBC, to do something in that vein, but more reality, which brought us Boy Meets Boy. Here's writer and scholar Dr. Eve Ng.
Boy Meets Boy was a moderate success for Bravo. It definitely garnered viewership. The earlier, smaller shows like Fire Island didn't. The convergence of gay leads and the reality genre, which as we know, was attractive to networks at that time, and it still is now because it's cheaper to produce and it gets lots of viewership. That's what helped usher in Queer Eye. In fact, Queer Eye supplanted what would have been a second season of Boy Meets Boy. So you see Queer Eye premiering in 2004, and then Logo is established in 2005. So very close together.
Logo was already becoming identified as Bravo's gayer younger brother. Well, maybe not brother.
I'd like to call to order this secret conclave of America's media empires. We're here to come up with the next phony baloney crisis to put Americans back where they belong, in dark rooms glued to their televisions too terrified to skip the commercials.
Early in her book, Mainstreaming Gays, Eve describes this opening of The Simpsons episode, The Fool Monty, from 2010.
Well, I think...
NBC, you are here to listen and not speak.
As we pan around the table of TV execs sitting behind their network nameplates, the two male-presenting Logo and Bravo execs are making out. And as a sidebar, this is also known by the keener Simpsons fans as the episode where The Simpsons potentially predicted the 2020 pandemic.
I think we should go with a good old-fashioned public health scare.
Yeah.
Logo initially wasn't doing the same thing. It started off with a bunch of documentaries and more kind of highbrow films, indie films, films that had queer stars. But when it turned to gay streaming and was like, how can we, as one of the execs said, scale up and improve our ratings, it looked to Bravo because Bravo was so well known for these queer-themed programs that were successful. And so Logo then started producing its own kind of Bravo-esque reality shows. So the gay equivalent of the Housewives shows, the A-list shows. Logo produced one season of the A-list New York, and then another one, the A-list Dallas. And the tagline was Housewives with Balls. So the implication was you're going to see the same kind of bad behavior and the same kind of drama, but it's going to be gay men. And Logo also introduced a bunch of other reality shows that had gay participants as the contestants or the leads or the judges. And so you see a kind of convergence. Logo started to look like Bravo in terms of reality programming.
And much of that sameness is a result of what Eve calls gay streaming. And to be fair, she first heard the term from a Logo executive in a meeting. She calls it a, quote, explicit strategy on the network's part. Gay streaming has two connotations. Gay streaming as in a TV product for a target audience, gay stuff for gays and for urban upmarket liberal straights looking for a bit of sophistication from their TV. But gay streaming was also referring to the mainstreaming of gay culture. Here's Wes.
When I went in for my interview, I spent the entire time, the casting interview, spewing gay politics. Because my idea was it was so important to be out, so important to vote. Marriage equality was important, all the gay icons. And so I just spewed all this, you know, political firebrand in my interview. And they didn't temper that down. I was that way on set. Did I see that on the show? No.
No. And of course, there's a reason for that, which Wes went on to explain. There was a twist and they couldn't give it away. That would ruin the game and the show. Who was gay and who was straight? A guy talking about Harvey Milk at brunch would have been considered a tell in 2002. Maybe also today. It certainly was in that context. Brian A. was the first suitor to be evicted from the house. Here's his exit interview.
I guess I was trying to, for once in my life, fly within the gaydar. But I guarantee you a lot of people that are watching the show would have thought I was gay based on either what I was wearing or just who I was sitting next to. I was trying my best to be a gay man.
To be a gay man. So our formal introduction to the mainstream via gay streaming indicates that there is a way to be gay, which has something to do with the way that you dress and who you sit next to and maybe Harvey Milk.
A lot of reality TV representations of queer people fit a particular mold. If we go back to Bravo, its original Queer Eye was very focused on consumption, fashion, food, style. In some ways, stereotypical representations of what gay men are interested in and are good at. So arguably, it's great that for the first time, it's gay men who are the experts and straight men who are clueless. But on the other hand, and, you know, nothing against Queer Eye and its great success, but those gay men were pretty desexualized, whereas on a show like Boy Meets Boy, there was more of a sense of gay men's sexual agency.
So not sexual, not political, in dresses like Brian A. in a tank top and board shorts. That's what reality TV is selling as a gay man. And even 7 years later in 2010, things weren't looking that much better.
Previously on season one of the A-List New York.
Do I look really masculine?
I didn't know I was a top until I saw that.
Just drop the hat because the hat looks weird.
There's not a market for fat, pasty models.
How was the longest you've been single?
Maybe 2 months in the past 8 years of my life.
You're kidding me.
How are you? I do want to apologize for my behavior. It was crazy madness.
The A-List was an attempt by Logo to get into the gay streaming market. Logo had started airing RuPaul's Drag Race the year before in 2009, but Drag Race still had a pretty low-budget shot-through-wax paper look and had yet to begin its rise to phenomenon. Or Ru-nomenon? Sorry, more bad puns coming in episode 5. The A-List was an attempt to glam things up a bit, with swish locations and Cosmo-throwing cocktail fights. But in the end, it was derided by the press, both gay and straight, as disappointing and stereotypical, and by entertainment blog of the moment Gawker, as a platform for the worst kind of, quote, fame-hungry, attractive, horrible people you could have imagined. Even that opening for season two, the final season, thankfully, makes it hard not to agree. And if that's gay streaming, I'm not sure it's the queer mirror anybody is looking for. This is Get Queer, and I'm Mel Woods. And this season, we're talking about queer reality TV, where it came from, how it got here, and what it's doing for us. This episode, gay streaming. This is Get Queer, and I'm Mel Woods.
American Idol runner-up Adam Lambert tells Rolling Stone magazine he's gay. He's quoted as saying, "I don't think it would be a surprise for anyone to hear I'm gay." Lambert says he wanted to share details now in order to be in control of the situation.
I actually was a little bit surprised about the level of support that I got. I thought that me being a little more alternative or whatever you want to call it would turn a lot of people off, and it was surprising to me how much support I got for being different.
So this is 2009, and a couple of weeks after Adam Lambert came second to Chris Allen on season 8 of American Idol. Adam has an album coming out. Rolling Stone gives him the cover. He's a featured story and doing Sit Down on 2020, you know, a popular in-depth news program. It's a big deal. People will be listening. People will be talking. But Idol's done. Adam's not on TV anymore, not really. Once in a while, he's, you know, a guest star on Glee, but not every week. It's not the same thing. Like Clay Aiken before him, while they were on our TVs and in our living room, it seemed like these guys were purposefully avoiding being named as queer. It wasn't like they were constructing straight lives and going on paparazzi dates with teen scream queens or the new Brandy, but there was something held back. And even though they hadn't come out in some official way, you know, on the cover of Rolling Stone or in a TV news magazine sit down with a journalist, we queers all knew what they were. Even Middle America suspected. Adam was right when he said no one would be surprised, because no one was surprised. It was implied queerness. But is that actually representation if it's only implied? If we don't know it's representation, I don't think it is. We are who we say we are because we name it as such. You know, thanks to Judith Butler. Emily Nussbaum, the Pulitzer Prize television critic, calls reality TV a genre conceived in a, quote, orgy of soap opera documentary game show in vaudeville. She goes on to say it, quote, upended the industry's economic model and rewrote the nature of fame. That's a lot. People are watching this. Queer reality TV participants need to be mindful that for a lot of folks who are being exposed to queerness for the first time as a result of queer reality TV, they are constructing what queerness is for those people, in what they do and don't do, in what they say and don't say. Again, to bring up Judith Butler, it's how they perform. Here's Wes again.
When you were a queer character on reality 20 years ago, you had to be queer, and that was your identity. Boy Meets Boy was a bit different because there was a lot of queer people, which I thought was amazing, and the twist of the straight male twist. But I think back then you decided as a queer person to do a show like that to make a statement, to be present, to get visibility to the movement. I think nowadays, because there is so much saturation of reality, I think that shifted a bit. I think there are still tons of people out there that want to do a show for the political visibility. But I think some people are just queer and they want to be on TV. And that's okay too, right? I think it shifted dramatically in terms of what the needs are and what returns are for people appearing on these shows.
Queer people who want to be on TV. Not even that. People who want to be on TV who happen to be queer. It sounds a bit like casual queerness, which is in some ways not entirely dissimilar from implied queerness, except that casual queerness has a bit more sex, a bit more point of view, and a few more fun shirts. And that shift that Wes talks about, Eve talks about that shift as well. In her book, she relates it to the Henry Jenkins theory of convergence culture. Here's Eve to take the academic sting out of that phrase.
One of the key ideas is that there used to be a stronger barrier between producers on the one hand, people who make the content, and viewers and audiences on the other. So the people that make it and the people that watch it. And changes in media production have made that barrier more permeable at one really obvious level, you know, via social media. We can actually communicate with producers directly, so we can make our voices known.
On another, perhaps less obvious level, that convergence is happening queerly too. Queer fans and participants start making queer work in production offices, on sets, in writers' rooms. It's 2012, season 4 of The Real Housewives of New Jersey. Kathy Wackel, whose main role has been as a pot stirrer for cousin Teresa Giudice's storyline, has a sister Rosie, a beloved aunt of Kathy's teenage kids. Now, Rosie has become a sleeper fan fave at this point. There's some implied queerness, a lot of, is she or isn't she? And then, after some buildup, Rosie takes her niece and nephew out to lunch to have this conversation.
So, you maybe have an idea, but just let me just tell you the story. After Papa died, right? You know, it hit me really bad.
Yeah.
One night he said to me, you know, I'm really worried. And I said, what are you worried about? He goes, because, you know, you're never going to get married, right? And I said, you know what, Dad? Probably not, you know? And he goes, well, I'm worried because he didn't want me to be alone.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, when I think about him, I get emotional.
Yeah.
But, and after that, you know, I felt really guilty. And it was all built up. And finally, I was like yelling it, you know, yelling. And I finally just came out with it. I went through it all by myself, all through my 20s into some of my 30s. It's not something I'll woke up and say, I'm going to do this because it's cool. No, it's something that
you're born
with. God made me this way. That's it.
Here's Wes.
That's one of the storylines I'm most proud of to have worked on in terms of all the stories I've told over the last 20 years from reality to what I do now. But it was authentic, it was heartfelt, and we got a lot of great feedback from that.
Yes, that Wes. He worked on Housewives. Wes Culwell, the winner of Boy Meets Boy.
But I actually learned a lot about production while I was on the show, Boy Meets Boy. And I found the behind the scenes way more interesting than what was happening on set and on front of the cameras. So I became good friends with the producers, the camera folks, the casting associates, the casting producers, and the executive producers as well. And it really kind of set my sights on, I think, a different trajectory of what I wanted to do. But Boy Meets Boy was a very interesting experience. It was, I would say, I don't want to say life-changing, but it was definitely a foundation where I think a lot of things were teed up for the rest of my last 20 years. You know, my first job was a PA. I came off out of that, you know, magazines, events, shows, and I was a production assistant on the same company that produced Boy Meets Boy. I gave me my first PA job. And within 2 weeks, I was the second assistant director because they thought saw I was serious and I was taking the job serious and I worked my butt off. So that was how I really launched that part of my career was, hey, I'll do anything. I will sweep up. I will go coffee runs. I'll do all that stuff because I need a job, but I really love this business. Let me show what I can do. And that's how it really launched me into being a producer for reality TV and now having my own production company.
So Wes had gone from being a queer reality TV participant to a queer reality TV producer. That's what we call queer convergence culture in reality TV. Maybe they didn't let Wes talk about politics at brunch as a participant, but as a producer, he can be part of the team that brings the first coming out to the Housewives franchise. That's Middle America visibility right there. That's representation. And it's gone beyond TV. Queer reality is everywhere.
It's easier now for regular people to produce our own content. We can make our videos, whether they're scripted series, whether it's talking head commentary, doing, you know, episode reviews or reaction videos. You can upload to video sites like YouTube or Vimeo in the old days, but now you don't even need those. You just need a social media account and some followers, right? There's now a blurring of legacy-produced reality programming on the one hand and social media influencers on the other. What's the difference between someone who has a YouTube channel putting out regular episodes and a network like Bravo or Logo also putting out episodes regularly? There's a whole genre of reality, a whole new kind of domain of content that wouldn't have been possible without what digital media and the internet has allowed.
The success of gay streaming, as Eve says in her book Mainstreaming Gays, is that it's not just straight people making use of queer content and writing queer storylines for straight people and appropriating queer content anymore. More queer content means more queer fans, and that means more queer participants, which means more queer producers, which means more queer content from real queer people. Real queer lives. And yeah, maybe it's casual, but for real representation, it has to be more than implied if we're serious about getting queer. I'm Mel Woods, and this has been Get Queer. Thanks to my guests, Eve Ng and Wes Colwell. Eve's book, Mainstreaming Gays, is available online, and Wes is the founder and director of Studio Box, a DC-based video production house. This episode was produced by Daniel McIver and edited by Jamie Folds. Get Queer was mixed at Sound Park Studios in Nova Scotia and produced by Pink Triangle Press in Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Mel Woods. Thanks for listening.